This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode Alpha was recorded back in June of 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Numbered Macro Voices episodes bring you timely market information each week. We cover the topics of the day and strive to keep the content as fresh and up-to-date with current market information as possible. Phonetic lettered episodes, like this one, are recorded well in advance so that we can air them during holiday weeks or if something goes wrong, such as a featured guest canceling on us at the last minute. This episode is tentatively scheduled to air on July 7th, 2016, because we plan to take the U.S. 4th of July holiday week off.
And I'm Aaron Chan. For our first timeless episode, we're going to air a preview of the first installment in a four-part series Eric's been working on called Accredited Investor Academy. So it's going to be Eric and myself this week, with no feature interview guest. Eric, please tell our listeners what your AIA project is about and what they can expect this week.
Well, when I sold my software company in the summer of 1998, my purpose in life changed rather dramatically from running the company that I founded to investing the proceeds from selling it. And frankly, I screwed up pretty badly at first. Accredited Investor Academy is an idea that I've been toying with for years. The whole idea of the first episode is to share the mistakes that I made in transforming myself from retired software entrepreneur to full-time private investor, in hopes that others won't repeat them. Then the rest of the series is designed to teach you about the world of alternative investments that are only available to accredited investors. Most of the content is pertinent specifically to high net worth accredited investors, but my hope is that our retail audience will also find the information informative as well. But since this is a total departure from our usual format, I want to be clear about what people can expect so that we don't waste anyone's time. If you are a high net worth individual investor, or if you're an entrepreneur who either recently came into wealth from a liquidity event or you expect to in the next few years, this show has your name on it. It's all about the hazards of dealing with the sharks on Wall Street and navigating the world of alternative investments that are only available to accredited investors under U.S. law. But frankly, if you're a veteran pro-finance guy who already knows all about hedge funds and private equity limited partnerships and private banking and so forth, this week's show might not be of interest. If your primary interest in Macro Voices is our feature interviews with the brightest minds in the industry or our timely content about this week's market action, well, sorry guys, we just can't do that for you this holiday week. So please tune in next week when we'll be back to our regular show format. And please also forgive the references to parts 3 and 4. Frankly, they don't exist yet, and you're not really going to find them at macrovoices.com, even if you hear us say that you can. We're airing this preview of part 1 in large part because we're still trying to gauge how much demand there really is for the rest of the series. We'll preview part 2 in episode Bravo, which will air the next time that we have a holiday conflict or something goes wrong with the regular numbered episode sequence. So I hope you enjoy this first part in the series, and I welcome your feedback on the general concept through our listener discussion forums at macrovoices.com/forums. We'll be back next week with our regular numbered episode format and another fantastic feature interview guest.
And folks, I strongly encourage you stay tuned. We can't cover current market topics this week, but I think you're really going to enjoy this special preview of Eric's Accredited Investor Academy. This was originally designed to air independent from the Macro Voices podcast, so it begins with a personal introduction from Eric.
Hi, I'm Eric Townsend. I was a technologist and entrepreneur in the software industry in the 1990s, and frankly, I managed to get a lot of things right early in life, selling my software company in a $31 million pooling transaction back in 1998 at the grand old age of 33. But unfortunately, as my personal mission in life changed from running the company that I founded to investing the proceeds from selling it, I made a lot of very costly mistakes. I had no idea what I was doing in my first encounters with Wall Street bankers, and frankly, they saw me coming. I made a lot of bad decisions and trusted all the wrong people. I lost considerably more than half of my net worth over the next decade as a result of these mistakes because I really had no idea how to reinvent myself from entrepreneur to private investor. After making a lot of mistakes and losing a lot of money, I finally fired the bankers and reinvented myself, first as a full-time private investor starting at the end of 2006, and then I eventually launched my own hedge fund in 2013. I now host the Macro Voices podcast, and I'm honored to interview some of the smartest people in the world of finance every single week. For years, I've felt a desire to help other entrepreneurs who are coming into wealth and who might be prone to repeating my own mistakes. So, as awkward as it may be to admit my worst mistakes in life publicly, I've created this four-part series to share my personal story with you and teach you what I've learned about being a sophisticated private investor. Now, to be sure, there's very real and lucrative opportunity to be found in so-called alternative investments, such as private placements, venture capital, private equity limited partnerships, and hedge funds, all of which are restricted by law and only available to wealthy investors. But quite frankly, there's very little solid, unbiased information about these so-called alternative investment vehicles available, other than what the people selling them will tell you. And guess what? The salesmen don't always tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The sales pitch always seems to leave out any credible discussion of the pitfalls and risks inherent to some of these alternative investment vehicles. So this four-part series is all about the alternative investments which are restricted by law to so-called accredited investors. The focus will be on what can go wrong and how to avoid making the same mistakes that I did.
And I'm Aaron Chan. I'm an investment analyst and co-host of Macro Voices podcast with Eric each week at macrovoices.com, and I'll be your co-host for this four-part special series. So Eric, people with enough money to qualify as accredited investors generally have busy schedules, so let's get right to the chase. What can listeners expect from this four-part series? And for those who may not have time to listen to the entire series, let's give them an outline of what order we're going to present this information in, so they can skip ahead to what interests them most if they so desire.
Part 1, the recording that you're listening to right now, is all about private banking, the one-stop shopping service that the big investment banks offer to high-net-worth individuals and families. More specifically, it's about what can go wrong if you place too much trust in private bankers, as I did. I think my story will be very instructive to newly accredited investors. But I know that some very busy people came here looking for specific information about how to invest in hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, and angel investing. So if one man's personal war story of dealing with Wall Street bankers doesn't interest you, feel free to skip part one. Private banking basically means trusting the boys and girls on Wall Street to manage your wealth for you, and my experience with it was not positive. Part two is all about what it means to reinvent yourself from entrepreneur to private investor. It covers a progression from hiring money managers to run different parts of your portfolio to learning how to do parts of the trading yourself, and concludes with some unexpected lessons that led me to launch my own hedge fund. Part three is about a broad category called private equity. It begins with angel investing. That means providing both the seed capital and the entrepreneurial expertise to help new entrepreneurs launch their businesses. It then goes on to cover venture capital and private equity limited partnerships, which typically invest in leveraged buyouts and other specialized transactions. All of these are investments that only accredited investors are allowed to participate in under U.S. law. Finally, part four is all about hedge funds. What are they? How do they work? What are the common hedge fund investment strategies? And what are the pros and cons of investing in hedge funds? We'll also cover fund-to-funds, which are hedge funds that invest in other hedge funds.
Okay, before we move on, let's start from the beginning. Eric, can you please define this whole concept of accredited investor? Like, what does this phrase even mean?
Well, let's start with where the concept comes from. The investment world is full of sleazeball scumbags and moral defectives, so the government needs to protect normal retail investors by imposing all sorts of burdensome regulations that make it very difficult for anyone other than a large financial institution to launch an investment fund that's open to the public. Now, as much as I don't care for government intervention in our lives, this is very necessary. If all investments were unregulated, the con men would be eating hardworking people for lunch and stealing their life savings. But thankfully, even the government understands that when it comes to sophisticated investors who know what they're doing, those people ought to be able to make their own decisions and enter into contracts at their own risk without government interference. So far, so good. Protect the naive retail investor from the crooks on Wall Street while allowing sophisticated investors to fend for themselves without the burden of government intervention. Now, so far, I love this story, on the surface at least. It appears to protect the people who need to be protected, but it keeps the government out of the way of the people who don't need that protection.
Okay, so how do they decide who qualifies as sophisticated enough not to need government interference in their investment decisions in order to protect them from nefarious actors?
According to the stupidest criterion imaginable, it is entirely about how much money you have and nothing else. So the head of the economics department at an Ivy League university, who might have three PhDs in finance and maybe even a Nobel Prize in economics, that guy doesn't qualify. Unless he has family money, his academic salary probably doesn't qualify him to be a sophisticated investor in the SEC's eyes. But the hairdresser from Wisconsin, who can't balance her own checkbook, but just won the $1 million state lottery, now she's deemed to be a sophisticated, accredited investor by the government because she has more than $1 million. The fact that she's arguably most at risk, although I might personally have said second most at risk, of being taken for a sucker by Wall Street criminals apparently just doesn't register with regulators. So according to the law, who is or is not sophisticated is determined entirely by how much money you have to lose, with complete and total disregard for how much you know about investing.
Okay, so I gotta ask, you said the lottery-winning hairdresser is only second most likely to be taken for a sucker by the sharks on Wall Street. So who's the first?
Professional athletes and Hollywood celebrities. These are people who derive their wealth from things like their looks or their singing talent or their athletic ability. And they seldom have a mind for financial matters. Pro athletes in particular generally have big male egos that are easy to play and, frankly, not a whole lot of financial acumen. The con men know this and focus their efforts on these people because they're the easiest targets. They qualify under the law as accredited investors, meaning that the usual rules that protect retail investors from the con men can be legally disregarded. People in Hollywood often respond very positively to the emotion of exclusivity, so they're particularly ripe targets for con men who play up how only a select few very special VIPs in Hollywood will be allowed to invest in this very exclusive investment, which of course is just whatever scam is being offered up at the moment. Now, of course, if this were up to me, the rules would be rewritten entirely based on objective criteria. You'd have to pass a formidable test to become an accredited investor, and that test would be designed to make goddamn sure that you know what you're getting yourself into and how to conduct a proper due diligence review. But accredited status would be available to anyone who's willing to put their time and energy into learning how to protect themselves, regardless of their asset level. But unfortunately, I don't make the rules.
Eric, since you don't, let's cover the ones the U.S. government stipulates. So what is an accredited investor under U.S. law, and who specifically qualifies?
In simple terms, a person with more than $1 million of investable net worth, not including the value of their primary residence. There's also another way to qualify based on having an annual income of more than $200,000 if you file your taxes individually, or $300,000 if you file jointly with a spouse. But frankly, for our purposes, I don't think the income-based qualification method is even relevant. Most alternative investment vehicles that are worth your time will have very large minimum investment thresholds, and it never makes sense to put all your eggs in one basket. So in my opinion, the kind of an alternative investment vehicles that we're going to discuss in this series are really only suitable for people with at least a couple $1 million of investable net worth, excluding the value of their primary residence.
And we should probably point out that these are the U.S. regulations, and these rules vary considerably in other countries. Wikipedia has an excellent article under the heading Accredited Investor that covers the rules in other jurisdictions. Now let's move on to private banking. What is it, and who is it offered to?
Private banking is the catchphrase for the highest level of service that banks offer to their wealthiest individual clients. The minimum personal net worth to qualify ranges from $1 million to $10 million, depending on who the service provider is. Generally speaking, the big retail investment houses, like, say, Fidelity Investments, would offer this service to anyone who meets the legal definition of accredited investor, but frankly, they don't offer much in the way of alternative investments. The value proposition there tends to be more about slightly more personalized service, no fee for wire transfers, and a special phone number to call where you don't have to wait on hold for as long. The big investment banks only offer private banking services to clients with several $1 million of net worth. Some have minimums as high as $10 million. The sales pitch is that these guys offer the pinnacle of service and the opportunity to access alternative investments that are only available to accredited investors. although frankly the pinnacle of service part was not my personal experience in dealing with these guys. Now, there are also private wealth managers. These are smaller shops that specialize in helping accredited investors navigate the universe of alternative investments that are available to them. They frequently also offer estate planning and other private wealth management services. I'm told that some of them offer better service than the big investment banks' private banking offerings, but I have no personal experience with them, so I can't vouch for them either way.
For the sake of any listeners who just came for the definitions, we've covered them now, and the rest of Part 1 is going to be about Eric's personal experience with the private banking services of one of the largest and most prominent investment banks on Wall Street. So feel free to skip ahead to Part 2 if you don't want to hear Eric's personal story. So Eric, I think it's already clear that your story isn't very likely to be used as a testimonial for the bank you dealt with.
I think that's a safe bet. But before we go on, I want to be clear. There are good guys in the world of private wealth management, and they're worth their weight in gold if you can find them. Some of them are regular listeners to our Macro Voices podcast, and the last thing that I want to do is offend them. But listen, guys, those of you who are truly among the good guys in private banking know just as well as I do that your industry on whole is pretty corrupt, and that as one of the good guys, you're in the minority. I hope you'll recognize that by telling my story about the encounters that I've had with the worst people in your profession, it only helps you differentiate yourselves as being in the minority who truly care about your customers' well-being.
Well, before we dive into your experience with private banking, let's start with a little background on your business experience. So give us the executive summary. How did you get to the point of being able to qualify for private banking services in the first place at the tender age of 33 back in the summer of 98?
I was the prototypical teenaged computer geek, having taught myself assembly language programming on a PDP-11 at the age of 12. I spent most of my teenage years as a high school hacker at MIT's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, starting in the late 70s. So I personally witnessed the transformation of the ARPANET into the public internet firsthand. And I was way ahead of my time in recognizing that commercial IT system designers, which we used to call DP systems in those days, were completely out of touch with what was possible. Specifically, I understood the power of what we used to call distributed systems to revolutionize corporate computing. Now, translating that into current IT parlance, I'm one of the guys who invented something that's now called service-oriented architecture, although that term hadn't even been coined when I sold my company and retired in 1998. So I started as a software engineer in the 80s, but quickly realized, number one, that other software engineers I knew were smarter and more talented than me, and number two, that the business managers in the software business were mostly incompetent idiots, hence the infamous Dilbert cartoons. So I recognized the opportunity to reinvent myself as the rare business guy who could talk to software engineers and fully understand what they were talking about, but still run the business end of the company. And I correctly recognized that I'd have far more value in that role than I would competing at writing code with engineers who were smarter and more talented programmers than me. I founded the Cushing Group in 1992 for the express purpose of commercializing the concepts that are now known as service-oriented architecture. We did a big project for Wells Fargo Bank in 1993, and the work that we did there helped Wells Fargo to become the world's first truly online bank, offering access to account balances and transaction history over the public internet beginning in March of 1995. By 1998, we were hotter than hot and couldn't hire enough people to meet demand. But I could also see that we were living in a bubble economy, and I knew that it was time to cash out. So I sold the Cushing Group to a public company who had no clue, frankly, what we did or what our value was. They loved our 28% net operating income, and the accounting rules of the day allowed our earnings to be retroactively accretive to their income statement, which, as far as I could tell, is all that they really seemed to care about, despite the fact that they had no clue what they just bought. We also had stock-for-stock pooling transaction accounting rules in those days, so my deal was extremely attractive with a $31 million valuation for a company that only had 35 employees and, frankly, no real assets other than the brain power of our engineering staff. After paying off the middlemen and my partners, my share would be about $18 million before taxes.
Okay, so the profile is basically a really smart technology guy turned businessman. And from your own description, your skill was more about being the smart technology guy than knowing the cutthroat, backstabbing world of Wall Street-style business. And then you cashed out and wound up with $18 million worth of stock in a public company. But since this was a pooling of interest transaction, those would be Rule 144 restricted securities that you could only sell after a holding period. And that meant you'd need the assistance of an investment bank to help you figure out your liquidity options, right?
Precisely. And sure enough, as soon as the deal was public, my phone was ringing off the hook. One of the calls was from a guy who said that he was a partner in the world's most prestigious investment bank. Now, I'm not going to name the bank because, frankly, I don't want the legal headache. So let's just suffice it to say, this guy was not exaggerating. This really was the most prestigious investment bank on Wall Street, and he was calling from their private wealth management group to tell me how lucky I was to qualify for their very exclusive services, which were only offered to clients with a bare minimum of $10 million of personal net worth. So my junior partners in the Cushing Group didn't qualify. Lucky them. Now at the time, I thought I wanted to be a venture capitalist. Frankly, I didn't understand at that time what venture capitalists did. But I wanted to run my own money. I wanted to do my own thing. It was the M&A lawyer who handled my acquisition who was most outspoken in talking me out of it. He said, "Eric, look, I've seen this before. You're a really smart guy, but you're a technology guy. You're a software guy. You're not a finance guy. You're not qualified to do this. You suddenly have enough money that it would be crazy for you to try to manage it yourself. You need the help of professionals, and you've got enough money that you can qualify to get the attention of the world's most prestigious investment bank. You cannot go wrong with the world's most prestigious investment bank." I will never forget that guy telling me those words, and without a doubt, the single worst mistake of my entire life was listening to that nonsense. You most certainly can go wrong with the world's most prestigious investment bank, and a lot of people have before and since my experience.
Oh boy, so what did you do?
Well, on this guy's advice, I went to at least hear the sales pitch from the world's most prestigious investment bank. I met a fellow that I'm going to call Benjamin Banker, obviously not his real name, but he was, in fact, a Harvard Business School MBA, graduated with honors, and told me how lucky I was to qualify for their very exclusive services. And he kind of made a joke about saying, you know, we bankers are sometimes accused of being greedy, and I want to tell you, we are greedy, but we're long-term greedy. And Eric, at your age, having made the money that you've made, you're easily going to be a centimillionaire, if not a billionaire. And we want to be with you every single step of the way, and we want to be your bankers for the next 50 years. He went on to tell me that what I really needed to focus on is what they call special opportunity investments. That's where it would be at for me. And he said never in the history of the world's most prestigious investment bank had they ever underperformed their performance targets for these special opportunity investments, which were typically not available to retail investors. These were only available to accredited investors, which I was now so happy to be. And they showed me some prospectuses for these things, and I'm looking at projected returns of 18%, 20%, 22% annually. And he's telling me in the 100-plus year history of the world's most prestigious investment bank, they've never, ever underperformed these targets. And I just couldn't believe it. And I said, wait a minute, this is too good to be true. Something is wrong here. And so they went on to say, well, you know, there is a little bit of a misleading aspect to this, which is you can't always have all of your money in these special opportunity investments. They're very hard to get into. Only our very best clients are offered these things, and some of your money will be in the public market. So if you blend together these 20% plus returns that you can expect from our special opportunity investments with your other public market investments, it would be fair to expect about a 15% IRR as a minimum. You could plan on that long term. Well, I did the math, and if I look at a 15% IRR on the money that I had made in the software business, it was huge, and I knew from what I had done in terms of my own reading and research about investing that I couldn't produce that as a minimum return in the long term just by investing in the stock market. I had a fair amount of experience at that point, having invested in mutual funds and so forth, and I really was enticed by this. Now, the reality of the situation, as anyone listening who's in the business knows, is these guys are trying to sell me the highest fee products on offer. They're full of crap. This is a bunch of BS. But I fell for it, and the reason is, you know, greed definitely interferes with our judgment.
Yeah, that definitely sounds too good to be true, Eric. So what happened next?
Well, I was still skeptical, but I went ahead and signed up with the world's most prestigious investment bank to try out just one of these special opportunity investments that they had available for me when they met with me. So I gave them $1 million, and this was an Asia-related short-term thing. It was going to be done within 16 months or something, and they were expecting a 20% return. And sure enough, within a year, it had returned more than 25%. And I just couldn't believe it. It's like, wow, this really is true. I can't believe it. I'm pinching myself. So I asked them, okay, you guys have sold me. What should I do? What do you recommend as far as an overall plan? I thought I wanted to run my own money, but I guess I really should take my lawyer's advice and let the most prestigious bank on Wall Street run it for me. What they advised me to do is they said, first, for any money that you're going to spend buying toys, which is perfectly understandable, just use a margin loan to finance that because you don't want to dilute your wealth. You want to fully invest your wealth. Now, of course, what that really means is they want to make fees on all of my wealth. They said that by investing, using a margin loan to finance the purchase of a yacht or a personal airplane or something, that those are assets. You buy them, but you can sell them, and therefore they don't really count as using leverage. They said it's not really leverage because they're assets you can sell. That's total nonsense, but that's what they told me. They said what you're going to want to do is focus on these special opportunity investments, and meantime, while you're waiting for those to come up, because you know the good ones we only let our very, very best clients into, but we're going to make an exception for you, Eric, because you're such a good guy and we like you. We're going to get you into one of the best ones. But we don't have it right now. So what you should do is put the rest of your wealth in, I forget what they called their fund. What it basically was an S&P 500 index fund with a ridiculously high fee structure. So it just tracks the S&P 500. They said, park your money there until we have a special opportunity investment that's really going to make killer returns for you.
So the first special opportunity deal they put you in worked out extremely well and built up your confidence in this whole story of sustainable long-term 15% returns. But what happened next?
Well, I got a call from Benjamin Banker one day, and he says, okay, I've got it for you. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. You got to come into my office. We're going to tell you how we're going to make you just filthy rich. And so I went in and met with Benjamin Banker and a couple of other people that were there, and they pitched me a 10-year private equity limited partnership fund that would start in 1999. And by now, this is probably spring of 99 that I'm meeting with these people. It would start later in 99, and it would go for 10 years. And they said, you know, you are locking up your liquidity with whatever you put in this thing for 10 years, from 99 to 2009. And basically, most people can't do that. And to put a significant amount of assets in a 10-year locked-up investment, you get a huge premium for that illiquidity. You're not going to be able to take the money out during that period, but you're going to make ridiculous returns. Now, this was a very, very exclusive special opportunity only available to the partners in the bank and their very best clients. But as a personal favor, because he liked me, he could get me in. Now, in reality, what he was pitching is something called a hybrid fund of funds. It is the most fee-laden investment vehicle on earth. It starts out with a very high fee structure fund that just invests in other funds, including this bank's own funds, which also have their own large fee structure. So you're paying fees on top of fees on top of fees. But I was, at this point, mesmerized by the 25% return that really and truly happened on that first special investment that they put him in. So I said, Benjamin, what do you recommend? How much money should I put in this thing? And there was a moment there, I'll never forget it now, although I didn't figure it out at the time. He hesitated, and he didn't answer the question directly of what he recommended. What he says, boy, you know, Eric, if I were in your shoes at your age with the wealth that you have, I'd be thinking about a $10 million allocation to this. Now, of course, professionals listening to this will recognize he didn't want to recommend anything because he couldn't possibly recommend anything that ridiculous. That would be 70% of my net worth in a single investment because he'd be breaking a whole bunch of securities laws. So he said if he was in my shoes, he would be thinking about this. I think he was trying to duck accountability for having recommended it in a discretionary account. So I asked about what the potential risks were, and he said the big thing is you're locking yourself up for 10 years. And, you know, if you couldn't meet the capital calls, if you couldn't pay the money that you put in, the $10 million, you would forfeit your entire investment. So you can't let that happen. But you're one of the very rare people who's got $10 million to put into an investment like this. And I said, wait a minute. Okay, I'm very excited about this opportunity, but even I know enough to know the biggest rule of investing is diversification. So you're talking about putting 2/3 of my assets in one investment. That doesn't make sense to me. And I'll never forget the look in his face. And he said, he leaned forward and he looked in my eyes and said, Eric, the beauty of this is it's inherently diversified. Total BS, frankly. But he went on to explain, well, see, this is a fund that invests in other funds. So just as if you were in the stock market, you would diversify across different stocks and different sectors of the market. This is investing in different sectors of private equity through different fund managers. What that really means is it's got more fees in it than any other investment on earth. He said, you're being basically rewarded with this huge illiquidity premium. And, you know, I just listened to this story. I thought, wow, you know, these guys are Harvard MBAs. They seem to know what they're talking about. I still wanted to do my due diligence, so I called everybody I could think of in my network. You know, my CPA in New Hampshire had never dealt with these guys before. He says, but that is the world's most prestigious investment bank. I guess if that's what they say, they know what they're talking about. I talked to the M&A lawyer again. He said, Eric, you cannot go wrong with the world's most prestigious investment bank. So I agreed to this plan, and when I went in to sign the paperwork, Benjamin Banker had some other paper for me to sign. He says, yeah, it's more efficient, it's better for you to have two separate accounts, one for this investment and one for your other investments, and, you know, to sign here, don't worry about it. That should have been a huge red flag, but at this point, I was naive enough to think these guys were on my side. And I'll explain later in the story what he was really up to and why he wanted me to have two different accounts. The other thing I came back and said is, boy, the $10 million still concerns me. You know, it seems like too much. And he said, well, the thing is, these are very, very exclusive investments. I don't know when the next one is going to come along. Could be years before you found something this good. And I believe that it might have been years before he had something with that high of a fee structure to sell me, which is what was really going on here. But he said, look, you might not get all that you ask for. If you ask for $10 million, you might only get allocated $7 million if there are too many investors trying to get into this fund. So you really should ask for more than you want.
Yes. Ask for more than you want because you're so lucky that we're selling you this investment with more levels of fees than you could even comprehend. And since we're doing you a favor here, we might not take all the fees you offer us. So you better try extra hard and ask for the biggest allocation you possibly could. And of course, none of this had anything to do with Benjamin Banker's bonus. What comes next, Eric?
Well, I had been suckered hook, line, and sinker. But to be sure, what had suckered me was my own Excel spreadsheet. I looked at the 18.5% IRR that they were saying this thing was going to return. That was the low end of their projection. Supposedly the 100-year history that they had never underperformed one of their expected performance targets. I think that story is probably BS. I don't have any way of verifying it or not. I did the math, and I figured out this $10 million investment is going to be worth $46 million minimum at the end of the 10 years in 2009. And I just thought, wow, this is wealth beyond my imagination. I can't believe that this is true. But boy, my M&A lawyer was right. I shouldn't be running my own wealth. If these guys can really do that kind of performance, I should let them do it. So I went ahead and committed, signed the paperwork, committed to the 10-year, $10 million commitment to this private equity limited partnership. And the way this works is you don't give them all the money right away. As they find investments and start to get ready to use the money, you get capital calls and you have to wire transfer money in to this thing. And it was going to come from my number one account with the world's most prestigious investment bank into the other account that they had opened just for the purpose of this investment. So at this point, I just did a total reset. I said, wow, I thought I wanted to run my own money and learn about this finance stuff, which I had always been fascinated with, but I guess I should just go and play instead. So I founded a company called Blue Water Ventures, and it was entirely about giving me something to do. It was never profit motivated. The charter of Blue Water Ventures was to invest in purchasing distressed sale assets of yachts and executive aircraft, two of my biggest hobbies and interests. I'm a very experienced pilot and flight instructor. I'm also a Coast Guard licensed yacht captain. So The idea was spend my time with my hobby interests, buying yachts on the cheap, fixing them up, selling them at a profit. That's obviously not really a profitable business, but it's a fun way to spend your life. So I remember the first project that I did was a 57-foot motor yacht that was a Viking motor yacht, which is a very well-respected name in the United States, almost unheard of in Europe. And this boat was over in Greece, where it had been converted to European electrical standards, and there was no market for it there. So I was able to buy it on the cheap, put it on a container ship, deliver it to the U.S., move it to South Florida, and I did the refit myself, converting the electrical system back to U.S. standards. I remember I was on my back in the engine room one day working on the isolation transformer, and my cell phone starts ringing, and it's somebody I'm going to call Susie Shortcake, obviously not her name either, but another Harvard MBA from the world's most prestigious investment bank. And she said she was calling to let me know that she was going to become my new banker because Benjamin was no longer with the bank and there's nothing to worry about, nothing at all. And I kind of thought, that's interesting. Just the way she said it, something seemed fishy. I did a Google search to see if I could find anything out about what happened to Benjamin. At least immediately, there was nothing available on Google. And I just sort of took Susie's my new banker. Okay, went back about my business and finished working on the isolation transformer. Well, several months later, I Googled it again and found out that in reality, Benjamin had been both fired and banned from the industry for life for something called a fairly well-known scheme called a backward-looking transaction scam. And the world's most prestigious investment bank was fined $175,000 by the SEC. They fired Benjamin for this. I would imagine that my account was one of the victims of this scheme. There was no disclosure of that by Susie, who insisted that Benjamin left for reasons that had nothing to do with my account. So there were some security law violations right there on that phone call on the engine room floor that I didn't figure out until years later. But basically, the way this works is these bankers have dozens of clients. First thing in the morning, the banker might send his trade desk a list of transactions he wants in aggregate for all of his clients. So buy 175,000 shares of IBM stock, buy 250,000 shares of whatever, XYZ stock. Then he's supposed to follow up with something called an allocation report, where he tells the accountants at the world's most prestigious investment bank, well, that 150,000 shares of IBM, 10,000 of it was for this account, and 20,000 of it was for this account, and 30,000 of it was for that account. What Benjamin was doing is he would send his trade desk instructions first thing in the morning. They would execute the trades, and he would accidentally forget, because he got tied up on a call with a client, to send that follow-up report. And then he would wait and see what those positions had done by the end of the day. Whatever was profitable, had made money on the day, that was allocated into his personal account. Anything that lost money, well, that was allocated into his customers' accounts. Mine was probably one of the victims of this scheme, although I have no way of proving that. I don't know what happened.
Wow, Eric. So hold on. That sounds like an ingenious way Benjamin used to rob his customers blind. But you said this is a well-known scheme. I mean, I can easily see how a big bank could have such a glaring hole in their checks and balances that this could happen once, but how could it possibly be that this is a well-known scheme and nobody took action to shore up that vulnerability?
Well, I have no way of proving this, but what I'm told is that the banks kind of want to have this loophole there, and the reason is they want to be able to take care of their favored political candidates. So if Hillary Clinton needs a favor from the world's most prestigious investment bank, the management can whisper in a banker's ear and tell him to use this trick. Benjamin wasn't doing anything at his management's behest. He was doing it for his own benefit and stealing from his customers. So he was fired and banned from the industry. But I have the impression that this kind of thing goes on quite a bit.
Hey, what's a little abject criminal activity among friends, right? Especially if they're politician friends. After all, this is Wall Street. So what happened next, Eric?
Well, 2000 is what happened next. So at this point, I've paid some of my taxes, so the $18 million is $15 million. Well, that $15 million, I get a statement in the mail, has turned into $13 million. So I call Susie up and I say, hey, I'm very concerned. You know, I've got this $10 million obligation to this private equity fund that's starting to draw down, and the $15 million has turned into 13. I think we should go to cash and get out of what was essentially an S&P tracker fund with a lot of extra fees tacked onto it. Susie insisted, no, don't worry. That's the worst mistake you can make. You don't want to panic and abandon your position. You want to ride it out. I thought, okay, well, They are the world's most prestigious investment bank. It doesn't make sense to me, but okay, I guess so. Well, a couple of months later, $13 million had turned into $11 million. So I called Susie again, and I said, Susie, we've got a $10 million obligation here, and there's only $11 million left, and you know, I've bought toys for this Blue Water Ventures project that are more than $1 million. So by the time the margin loan is satisfied, I'm getting really, really concerned. I won't be able to satisfy this. And you guys emphasized to me that if I can't meet the capital calls, I could forfeit the entire investment. She said, relax, don't worry. The capital calls are staggered with distributions. So for several years, you're calling down capital, but you're still calling down capital when you're starting to get your first distributions. So the whole $10 million is never really drawn down at once. You don't have to worry. Stay with your investment. Don't panic. You don't want to sell at the bottom. That's a mistake. Okay, I thought, I'm really getting scared, but they are the world's most prestigious investment bank. My lawyer told me I can't go wrong with these guys. Well, a couple of statements later, $11 million has turned into $9.7 million, and I outright panic. Call Susie up, and I say, Susie, this is crazy. I told you guys when we were at $13 million, like, you know, $3.5 million ago, we should go to cash because I've got to have $10 million to cover this obligation. It's a contract that you guys told me I can't get out of, and I'm committed to for the next 10 years. So Susie calls the fund. And she talks to her boss, and she calls me back, and she says, look, I've spoken to all of the people and all of the relevant departments, and they've told me you have absolutely nothing to worry about. The staggering of the capital calls and distributions, it's going to be fine. We're doing the right thing. You've got your money in the right place. And I thought, tell myself, foolishly, that... And I guess at this point, it never occurred to me that they could actually be giving me this advice just because they want the fees on the stupid tracker fund. But I think that's what was going on. So I tell myself that I need to trust the world's most prestigious investment bank, even though this strategy makes no sense whatsoever to me.
Yeah, the world's most prestigious investment bank seem real trustworthy from the story so far. So Eric, what next?
Well, I didn't have very many choices. Remember that at this point, I've already signed the contract. I'm committed to the 10-year obligation through 2009. And I figured that if they got me this far, I know that they're on the hook because they're responsible for running my money. And if I pulled the plug and I insisted that they do it a different way, then they could say that I interfered with their strategy or something. So I'm thinking by letting them make all the mistakes, maybe I'm better off that way, but I'm really getting nervous about how I got into this. Now, frankly, I should have known all along. These people are above the law. They get away with anything they want, and I had no recourse against them. Well, it was probably May of 2003 or so that I'm still trusting these guys. For Blue Water Ventures, I was delivering an 87-foot long-range motor yacht from Florida to Maine. My house in Maine, I had all set up for doing boat refits, so I had probably the most elaborate residential dock system on the coast of Maine that could easily accommodate a 100-foot yacht, and I built a big 5,000-square-foot workshop for doing refit work on the boat. By the way, that house with the docking and everything is for sale right now, 5 acres of oceanfront on the coast of Maine. If anybody's interested, I'll send you a video. But I get there, we get the boat tied up, I've been at sea for 5 days, out of touch with everything, and the answering machine is flashing. Well, it's a voicemail from Susie saying, hey, listen, we've got a capital call coming up on your private equity partnership. There's not enough money in your account to cover it, so what do you want to do? So I called her up and I said, what do you mean what do I want to do? I'm not involved in this. You're running my money for me. I don't want to do anything. I want you who told me, quote, you have nothing to worry about when I called you for the fifth time 2 or 3 years ago and told you I was concerned about exactly this scenario happening. You told me up and down I had absolutely nothing to worry about, so I want you to figure it out. I don't want to do anything. And she said, oh, well, you know, I'm looking at my diary notes here, and I don't have any record of that conversation, but I do see that you came in when you signed up for this investment, and you told us that you wanted to separate your accounts into two accounts, one discretionary and one self-managed, and that you wanted to put this investment in the self-managed account. So in terms of our discretionary relationship with you, we don't have any responsibility for your private equity investment. And that's when it hit me. I realized the whole business with the two accounts this guy knew that he couldn't possibly get away with telling me or recommending in a discretionary account that he could be held accountable for to overallocate 70% of my net worth to a single investment. So I realized these people are just complete total criminals. So I went down to meet with Susie and her boss. Her boss just, I'll never forget this guy. He just, with a completely straight face, looked me in the eye and says, yeah, what I recommend, this private equity investment is not for you. It's not a good fit. You shouldn't be allocated. You're over-allocated and you put too much of your investment in it. Of course, you did that in your non-discretionary account. That was your decision, not ours, which is total bullshit. That's not how it happened. But what we can liquidate it for you. We can get you 20 cents on the dollar, and I recommend you liquidate the whole thing. And I just looked at this guy, and I thought very seriously about breaking his nose right then and there in the conference room. But I know that these guys have very good lawyers. So I didn't do that. But I said, oh, well, I don't think I want to do that. I was forced because I had no other choice. Remember, if I don't meet the capital calls, I forfeit 100% of my investment, so I could lose all of my net worth. So I immediately put the 87-foot motor yacht up for sale at a distressed price, try to get rid of it as quickly as I could to raise cash, and I was forced to sell 20% of my $10 million investment in this private equity fund at pennies on the dollar. As a result of that and the fact that this thing, it had lost money for most of its life, it didn't come anywhere close to its performance objectives that they had said they had never, ever underperformed in the history of the bank. By the time I got to 2005 or so, my net worth was about $5.5 million.
That's unbelievable, Eric. So they actually lost more than two-thirds of your original $18 million investment. What did you do?
Well, that's not quite true. The $18 million, at least three went to pay for taxes. I had spent money on toys. I was buying yachts. I was building an experimental airplane. I was doing all kinds of fun projects. And that was frankly based on their advice. They told me I could comfortably spend, Susie told me one day, I could comfortably spend about $3 million a year and had plenty of investments to be able to support that lifestyle, which is utter nonsense. I mean, they lost realistically about half of my net worth. The rest of it went to buying toys that they told me I could afford and doing other things. But they lost more than half, all told. So in 2006, I reinvented myself. I fired the bankers and reinvented myself as a private investor. And I couldn't really do anything until then because for several years, you know, every penny that I possibly had had to be paid into this private equity partnership. And I was, you know, literally living a very reduced lifestyle despite supposedly being a millionaire because I had no liquidity and everything was tied up in this thing. As they finally started to distribute some of this money back, I reinvented myself as a private investor, running my own money, firing the bankers. I couldn't fire them completely because I was still obligated to this 10-year commitment, but I tried to start doing my own thing. So I tried angel investing. I learned that was not for me. I don't want to elaborate now because we're going to spend all of part three talking all about angel investing and other kinds of private equity investing. But I really fell in love with macroeconomics, and I certainly did far better on my own. I make money as opposed to the world's most prestigious investment bank, which only lost money for me. And I've been a much happier guy ever since.
So couldn't this have just been an isolated case of one sleazy guy who maybe wasn't representative of the private banking community as a whole?
Well, Benjamin was definitely sleazier than most, but frankly, I think Benjamin's ethics are probably representative of the private bank offerings of the major investment banks. My impression of how this works is the good guys in this business generally figure out that big banks are kind of sleazy, and they end up going to smaller private wealth management firms that perhaps offer a little bit higher quality. Whether or not that's actually true, honestly, I don't care to find out. I trust myself and nobody else. But as far as the private banking is concerned, you know, when I moved to Hong Kong in 2009, I did make the rounds and meet with all of the private bankers in town and just get a sense of what they had to offer just to see how it would go. Now, remember, at this point, I'm 3 years into the process of reinventing myself as a private investor. So I actually know something at this point. And I qualified for residency in Hong Kong with an investor visa, which required that I had to invest $6.5 million Hong Kong dollars, about 750,000 US dollars, in the Hong Kong stock market. And I didn't want to take any market risk. I wasn't particularly excited about the market at that time, in the beginning of 2010, end of 2009. So I ended up hedging that position fully. I was long in my qualifying account for the investor visa, and I had an equal and opposite number of short futures on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange in my futures account in order to neutralize my market exposure to flat net notional exposure. And it was interesting, each one of the investment bankers I went and showed this to, and I told them exactly what I just told you, why I had this position and how it was hedged. And every single one of them came back and said, oh, well, you know, that's too large of a position in one thing. You know, you really need to diversify that. And you got to remember, these guys don't know anything about investing. It's not their skill set. They're a bunch of salesmen whose job is to wine and dine people. And to them, diversification is just their little buzzword for an excuse to sell you a higher fee product. So they're telling me over and over again how I need to diversify this one large single holding in 388.HK, which is the Hang Seng Stock Index ETF. And I told them over and over again, I just told you I have that fully hedged with an equal and opposite futures transaction. I have no market risk. It doesn't need to be diversified. They literally could not comprehend that concept. It was too hard for them. They didn't get it. And it really just spoke to me, you know, once I began to learn only a little bit about markets and investing, how little these private banker clowns, at least the ones that I encountered in Hong Kong, actually knew. So between incompetence and sleaze, I really don't have a whole lot of use for big bank private bankers. I'm sure there are some good guys out there, you know, if you can find one, good for you. But I've given up and I basically just trust myself.
And so by 2009, this 10-year private equity fund that started in 1999 would have wound down. So, Eric, please tell me you finally got access to what was left of your money.
No. They still have it today in 2016, as we're recording this in June of 2016. Somewhere in the fine print, it said that if market conditions were not favorable, they could extend the life of the fund beyond 10 years. And in fairness, in 2009, market conditions were not all that favorable. As far as I can tell, what happened is they extended it, but eventually after a certain period, after it's extended for a couple of years beyond that, they stopped making fees on it. So as far as I can tell right now, it's abandoned. They don't care about it. I call them every year and I say, okay, is it 2009 yet? You know, and they say, what do you mean? I say, well, you've got this investment that I'm in from 1999 to 2009. You've still got more than $1 million of my money that hasn't been distributed. There haven't been any distributions in the last 6 months. What's going on? Oh, well, we think that the fund, they're going to be talking to some brokers about liquidating that by the end of 2014. Or by the end of 2012. I call them in 2013. It's the same story. In 14, it's the same story. In 15, it's the same story. For a while, it was a couple $1 million that they still had. It's down to about $500,000 now. But no, they still haven't given the money back. And on the whole, I lost money. The fund overall did a little bit better than break even during its lifetime, but they haven't distributed the money yet. So if you count only the money you actually got back, it's at a loss. And if you consider the 20% of the investment that I had to sell for pennies on the dollar, it's a big loss.
I gotta say, I'm so jealous that I don't qualify for these exclusive private banking services myself. Eric, can I assume that from this story that your advice to others would be to avoid these guys like the plague?
Well, that's my approach, but I want to bring in another aspect of this. I ended up joining a club for high net worth individual investors that was very much about learning to do a better job at managing your own money. We're going to talk in part two in detail about these clubs, so I'm not going to go into it now. But one of the guys I met there, I'm going to call him Larry, not his real name. I'd been in the club for a few months, and they heard the story that you just heard when I first got there. Larry approached me one day after a meeting. He says, Eric, I'd like to take you to lunch. I want to talk to you sometime. And so we sat down at lunch. We went to a little cafe just north of 14th Street in New York. And Larry looked at me and he says, Eric, you know, when I first met you and I heard your story about being taken to the cleaners by private bankers, please don't be offended, but I thought you were an idiot. And then you came to our meetings and you're starting to tell the pro-finance guys in the group about Triffin's dilemma and exorbitant privilege and all these monetary policy concepts that even the professionals hadn't heard of before. So I figured out you're a really smart guy, but I just don't get it. Because let me just tell you the story about like the first job I ever had. I was a runner on the New York Stock Exchange back when New York Stock Exchange had runners. Larry is about 25 years older than I am. So he says, the first job I had, my first boss told me when a boxer steps into the ring in the sport of boxing, he knows that the other guy's intention is to knock him out cold. And if we're talking about the big leagues, where maybe the title that's worth millions of dollars is at stake, the other guy will intentionally cause your death if you give him the chance to, in order to eliminate you as a competitor. So you never step into the ring without always keeping your guard up and knowing the other guy's intention is to kill you dead if you give him the chance to. And I said, Larry, what a coincidence. My very first boss at the same age when I was 17 told me that exact same story. So Larry's jaw dropped and he says, well, if you learned that at the age of 17, how the hell did you manage to be so stupid at the age of 33? And I said, Larry, I heard that story, but I forgot about it by the time I was 18, because in my industry, my experience was that that's not really the way business worked. I didn't need that idea of everybody's out to get me, because frankly, the customers that I worked with were some really honorable guys that I had fantastic relationships with, and I had honor and trust and, you know, didn't have to think that way.
So Eric, what did Larry say to that?
Well, he couldn't believe it. And I said, Larry, you know, put your seatbelt on because I'm going to tell you the best lessons that I learned in my experience as a businessman. Number one, always leave the other guy room to make a profit. This is something I ran into several times in the software business. You get a lot of engineers starting their own small companies, and they don't know how to price their own services. They don't understand how much overhead is going to cost them, and they underprice themselves. And you have to know that, you know, as tempting as it is to take advantage of that guy and sign the contract at a price that you know he can't possibly make a profit at, what's going to happen? He's going to go out of business. So I have plenty of experience telling guys, your price is too low. You need to increase it so that you can break even at least in order to do this deal. Larry's jaw totally dropped on that one. And I said, another rule, never negotiate selfishly. Always focus on working collaboratively. Don't think about your negotiating opponent. Think about your negotiating partner and focus on finding the better deal for both parties. I'm often smarter than the other guy is at looking at the deal and figuring out what's best for his interest and best for my interest and figuring out a deal that works better for both of us. And another rule that I told Larry is sometimes the highest profits come from what you give away for free. Well, there was one point when I said what you give away for free, I literally got concerned. I thought Larry was going to have a heart attack in the restaurant. So eventually, he doesn't have a heart attack. He leans forward and he says, Eric, I never knew that business worked that way in your industry. I have no experience with software. But he leaned forward and looked in my eyes. And he's, again, quite a bit older than I am, kind of a father figure. He looks at me and he says, Eric, I want you to trust me. You're in New York City now. You're working with Wall Street guys. This is my domain. This is where I'm the expert. And I want you to go home right now, and I want you to buy a picture of Muhammad Ali or one of these prize fighters, and I want you to tape it up on your mirror so that you see it every morning so that you don't forget you're in Manhattan now, and Wall Street does not operate under the culture that you are used to. And I said, Larry, believe me, I figured it out. I got the memo. I was a total sucker at first, but I get it. It's a different culture. Now, Larry is a nine-figure guy, centimillionaire. But frankly, I feel richer because although I'll probably never have anything close to Larry's money, my career in business was incredibly rewarding to me on a personal level. I had relationships with my customers that were based on friendship and trust and respect. I didn't have to live in this culture of feeling like everybody was out to get me. And frankly, I'd rather have had my experience in life than Larry's experience.
So, Eric, I assume someone like Larry knows better than to get involved with these private bankers.
Well, no, actually, that's the opposite is true, and that's the reason I brought it up. Larry gave me at that lunch meeting a lesson on private banking. And he said, look, I know you feel like these guys totally screwed you over, and they did, but that's because you let them. And he said, look, I have as many private banking relationships as I possibly can. Every single major investment bank, I am a private client of them, and I have several million dollars with each one of them. Why? Because I know how to play them for everything they're good for. Anytime my wife wants to go to Art Basel, which is really hard to get tickets for, or we want to go to some sporting event, we want tickets to the Red Sox-Yankees game or whatever, I just send an email to my bankers and I say, whoever gets me the best tickets with the best seats first is going to win my loyalty. And these guys are on it. They know how to take care of their high net worth clients. Now, would I ever trust them to give me advice about my investing decisions? What, are you crazy? I would do that after hell freezes over. But you do learn to develop a relationship with these guys. And he says, I'll tell you a perfect story. It just happened a couple weeks ago. I got a call from a very good friend of mine, one of my private bankers. And he says, Larry, you got to help me out. My boss is on my case. I'm not bringing in enough what's called ultra high net worth guys, 50 million plus guys, to look at this new fund that they're trying to pitch, which is a total waste of time. So would you please do me this favor? So he says, sure. Puts on his suit, goes down, meets with these guys. They pitch the fund. He looks to his friend and says, well, Joe, you're the one I trust. What do you think? Make sure the boss heard him say that. Oh, well, this is the best investment we've ever had, Larry. I think you should go all in. Oh, really? Well, I want to think a little bit more about it, but I trust you, Joe, so I think we might be able to do some business here. The boss hears that. They get up. Joe then takes Larry to Per Se for lunch, where they talk about women in sports, because Joe knows better than to ever bring up this stupid waste of time fund again, and it's all a game. Now, for any listeners who don't know, Per Se is probably the most exclusive restaurant in New York City. Lunch there with wine, and if Larry was there, there was wine, is probably several thousand dollars. And this is just a game that they play. And I should also disclose, I made up Larry's name, and also Larry's actually two different people that I met at this high net worth investor club, just for the sake of true disclosure.
That's interesting. You know, I find a certain irony in the fact that you felt obliged to fully disclose that. It seems the company you were keeping in New York was used to a less forthcoming style. Let's just put it that way. So I'm sure our listeners who haven't experienced the investment banking business firsthand must be wondering, how is it even possible that business culture could be so different between the software world you grew up in and Wall Street?
Well, I think it's the nature of the deals. You know, in software, collaboration pays. Let's say you've developed some piece of software that cost you a couple $100,000 and it's working and tested and debugged and it's there, and your competitor doesn't have it, but you know he's out talking to angel investors trying to get the money to develop it. Your non-recurring engineering is sunk cost. It's already paid for. It doesn't cost you anything to give your competitor that software. So you now can think out of the box. Well, what can I do to entice this guy to not compete with me? Can I make a deal to give him the piece of software that I already paid to develop in exchange for him agreeing that we're going to split the market up and he's not going to compete with me and we can both be more profitable because we can have higher profit margins? The Wall Street deals don't work that way. There's a certain size pie and you get your part of it and I get my part of it and we're going to negotiate with the boxing mentality for who gets a bigger slice. And I think it's just a difference in the culture that exists on Wall Street.
So did you eventually sue the world's most prestigious investment bank? And if not, why the hell not?
Well, I should have, to be sure. I think that it was my own greed and mental state. When I figured out that Benjamin Banker had been fired, I was still conned into this idea that the $10 million investment was going to turn into $50 million by the end of 2009. So I feel like a complete fool for being taken for such a sucker, but by the time that I figured it out and did a little bit of research, there's this legal doctrine that says the statute of limitations for these things is a couple of years after you either knew or should have known. And by the time that I was ready to sue these guys, it was more than that amount of time since I probably should have known. Now, could I still have sued them? I never even talked to a lawyer about it. I felt so embarrassed that I'd been taken for such a sucker that I never really followed up. It wasn't really until I was studying myself for the Series 65 exam in 2012 that I figured out just how egregiously these people had violated almost every securities law in the book. And I literally was going through this study guide thinking to myself, chapter after chapter, I know I'm eventually going to get to a securities law that they didn't break in my account.
So at this point, I have to believe a lot of our listeners are wondering the same thing that I am. And it's, why in the world are you coming out and telling such a humiliating story of being taken for a sucker publicly by these banks?
Well, it's because I truly want to help other entrepreneurs coming into wealth. You know, guys like Larry will never know the pleasure of giving something back and helping other people. If you already think like Larry, if you made your money by running used car dealerships or whatever, okay, good for you. You're probably better equipped than I was to go deal with these guys. But Wall Street is tougher than you know. They are better at it than you are if you're a used car salesman. It's the same tactics, but these are Harvard MBAs, and they know how to run a con job. If you do decide to trust a private banker or a private wealth management service, my message to you is you owe it to yourself to recognize that the due diligence you do on choosing the right person to entrust with running your money is every bit as important as the amount of effort that you put into amassing your wealth to start with. So think about how much work it took you in running your business in order to get to the point of your liquidity event where suddenly you're a multimillionaire. You should put just as much effort into finding the right guy if you're going to trust someone else to run your money. My experience, I'd much rather learn to do it myself.
Well, that's a hell of a story, Eric. And, you know, I really admire your courage in telling it publicly for the sake of hopefully helping others avoid the same mistakes. But let's move on. What can our listeners expect from the rest of this four-part series?
Well, after I lost most of my net worth, thanks to trusting the world's most prestigious investment bank, I eventually did what I wanted to do back in 98 and what I should have done back in 98 until I was talked out of it by my lawyer, which is to learn to run my money myself. So it was the end of 2006 when I started to reinvent myself as a private investor. I tried angel investing. That was not for me, but it is for other people. We're going to talk in detail about that in part three. I found that being a private investor was way more rewarding and also more financially lucrative than letting the world's most prestigious investment bank run my money for me. So after finding my success at my own trading, when I was living in Hong Kong full-time, I had I'd organized a roundtable of traders, mostly hedge fund guys, and we would just talk about what's going on in the market, share trading ideas, and so forth. And once these guys got to know me, they said, Eric, you know, we've met other private investors, with private investors in air quotes, guys that take their iPhone with them to the golf course so they can monitor their stock trades. You sit in front of 9 computer monitors for 14 hours a day. You're doing all of the work of running a hedge fund, except for calling a lawyer and turning it into a hedge fund. You're crazy not to do that and allow other people to invest alongside you so you can, you know, make fees on doing that. So I resisted that advice for a couple of years because, frankly, I didn't want to be part of this industry. I don't really like the culture. But eventually, I realized, and we'll talk in part two in more detail, about some lessons that I learned that made me realize that launching my own fund really was right for me. So that's part two, is the process of reinventing yourself from entrepreneur to private investor, and different aspects of doing that. And then comes angel investing, venture capital, and private equity. That's part three. And finally, part four is about hedge funds and fund of funds.
So unfortunately, we're out of time. Eric, what are your closing words to entrepreneurs like yourself listening to this program who are either already coming into wealth or expect to in coming years as their businesses mature towards liquidity events or an IPO?
Well, first of all, retirement sucks. Being a full-time private investor is way more fulfilling to me and rewarding than being a young retiree living on a mega yacht in Florida. So please trust me on that. The downside is you're living in Larry's culture, at least on what's called the sell side. The salesmen of Wall Street are people that I try to stay away from. I want to be clear, though, that that's not everybody. You know, some of the most interesting, fascinating people I've met in my life are finance guys, but they're the people on the buy side, the people that understand finance theory and macroeconomics and analyzing markets and so forth, viewing how the world works through the lens of economics and markets is the most fascinating thing that I've ever done. It's way more interesting than designing distributed software systems. So part two is going to be all about how to reinvent yourself as a private investor. And my considered opinion is you're better off skipping the private banking thing and learning how to do it yourself. So that's where we're headed with part two.
Great. So thanks for joining us, everybody. And please also check out Macro Voices, the weekly podcast Eric and I co-host. Eric interviews the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics each week after we do our own review of the week's market action. Benjamin Banker and Susie Shortcake are definitely not on the guest list, but some of the brightest minds in the business definitely are. Macro Voices is always free of charge at macrovoices.com, or you can subscribe for free in iTunes just by searching the iTunes store for Macro Voices. You can also find the remaining three parts of this special series for accredited investors at macrovoices.com. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan, wishing all of you better luck than Eric's had dealing with the investment professionals on Wall Street.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.